This is not just any podcast. This is episode 5 of Historical Inaccuracies, a history podcast. I still feel like I'm either an idiot or working on a sex line when I do that, honestly. I really do have a very sexy voice. Oh, thank you. I need to have a look into doing voice acting at some point. I think Cam always tells me that. I think, Maria, I feel like you and I would do quite well in the relaxation and breathing exercises industry.
Both the first somebody said, and, I am a calm person. Maybe just a calm voice. Thank you.
And breathe in and breathe out. Welcome, listener, to the 5th episode of Historical Inaccuracies. We are a group of friends who love to talk nonsense about all things history. There's 2 Scots, Kelly.
Hello.
And Cameron.
Hello.
A Greek, Maria.
Hello, my friends.
Oh, steady on, Maria. And an English girl, me. My name is Becky, and it is my turn to host this week's podcast on dun, 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 the mysteries of history.
Woohoo! We love that.
Yay! Before that, however, there is the matter of the fact of the day. So the one that I have chosen today is one that is very, very modern history and still affects us now. On the 26th of April 1986, an unexpected power surge caused a rupture in Reactor 4 at the Soviet Union's power plant in Chernobyl, Ukraine. Radioactive contamination drifted over large swathes of Ukraine, Belarus, and parts of Western Europe. Following a failed safety test, a nuclear reaction saw the sudden release of massive amounts of superheated cooling water, rupturing the reactor core. This was immediately followed by an open-air reactor core fire, which pumped radioactive particles into the atmosphere. Anyone who has seen the recent and incredible Chernobyl TV series has some idea of the utter ridiculousness of the following few days, but the official death toll still sits at around 100. Any thoughts, folks? Any thoughts?
I have actually something that's quite interesting. So initially, if I remember correctly, after the blast, I think it was actually Sweden or Norway that actually began to kind of like record and find out why there were so many radioactive particles in their kind of like countries. And interestingly enough, there are certain farms, believe it or not, in Wales, of all places, that still have large amounts of radiation due to this. And they can't have, like, you know, for example, livestock grazing in certain fields, etc.
I had heard this myself, actually. So, yeah, it would be interesting at some point. We may consider doing a Chernobyl special and really kind of delving more into the modern effects of Chernobyl. I don't know what everybody thinks of that.
I'm definitely up for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on. Now, throughout history, there are various mysteries which have influenced and inspired generations of writers, books, screenplays, television episodes and series, and dare I say it, fan fiction writers. And we wanted to spend this week's podcast exploring. And we wanted to spend this week's podcast exploring 4 of these mysteries: the princes in the tower, the Roman legion in China, the lost colony of Roanoke, and finally, the lost city of Atlantis. At the end of each segment, and just for a laugh, I'm going to ask all of us to vote on which explanation they think is the most likely, and thus solving, on this podcast at least, 4 very frustrating and long-lived mysteries. So, without further ado, Maria, the princes in the tower, please.
Thank you, Becky. And what it is perhaps the greatest of all cold cases in history, in my opinion, is the prisons at the tower. So the princes were Edward V and his brother Richard, Duke of York, the sons of Edward IV and his queen, Elizabeth Woodville. Let me just say here that Elizabeth Woodville is one of my personal heroines, one of the greatest women in history, again, according to my opinion. And I would love to have a podcast on her life, dedicate a whole podcast on the mystery that was her life before she became queen and after.
We could totally do that.
Thank you very much. It's a very, very interesting history for the whole family, and especially her as a woman living in those ages. Now for some background on the prisons in the tower. So Edward IV was the first English king who belonged to the House of York. He managed to restore some kind of stability and peace to the country after the civil wars, known better as the War of the Roses, during which the throne had briefly been seized by the House of Lancaster. Now, although the House of York managed to triumph over Lancaster and they put their own king back in power, the tensions were still boiling beneath the surface, and the, theme of succession was a tricky affair. So here's what we know. In April 1483, Edward dies suddenly at the age of just 40. Now, his eldest son, Edward V, is proclaimed king, but the young Edward was just 12 years old at the time, and so a Lord Protector was required to help him through that his, minority, and that role fell to the new king's uncle, Richard. Now, Edward V was escorted to London by his uncle Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and brother to the former king. The heir was taken to the Tower of London, where monarchs had traditionally spent the night before the coronation since the 14th century. Despite its later reputation as a scary prison, the Tower was actually quite a sort of like luxurious residence for the royals. So the young king didn't suspect anything that, when he and his brother were led there. Now, the two boys had no idea they would play a fundamental part in making the Tower's, dark reputation for the years to come, because they will literally emerge from behind its stone walls. Now, the coronation of the young king was set for the 22nd of June, but soon events would take a dramatic turn. Now, his father's marriage, Edward IV, was declared bigamous, right? And it was sort of annulled. Now, Richard was himself declared king as Richard III, that we all know. And then young Edward and his brother, Richard, literally vanished into the tower, apparently never to be seen again in public. It wasn't until 1674, right, that any trace of the lost royals was discovered when workmen found two small skeletons buried in the base of one of the tower's staircases. Charles II, the king at the time, accepted the at the time widely approved theory that these were the bodies of the missing princes, and he had them interred in Westminster Abbey. Now, these bones, the very same bones, had been reburied in an urn in 1674 and placed in the chapel of the abbey, right? And these skeletons aroused much interest and debate, as they were believed by many historians to be the bones of the two princes. In 1933, the skeletons of the two young boys, one aged about 10 and the other about 12 or 13, were then examined by L.E. Tannery and W. Wright, sort of the experts at the time. Now, there have always been rumors about them, and the most, let's say, famous account we have is Thomas Moore's 1518 work, The History of Richard III. Now, he was quite sure that these boys were murdered by their uncle Richard, and Shakespeare as well portrayed Richard III as an evil bastard. I personally disagree, but that was the case at the time.
Same here,
Yes.
I agree too.
Thank you very much. So that guy, Thomas Moore, states in his writings that the princes were buried at the stair foot, meatly deep. And to be honest, in 1674, the two skeletons were found buried beneath a stone staircase during what were alterations at the tower at the time. So to back this theory up, the guys in 1933, Tannery and Wright, also concluded that the princes had probably died in the summer of 1483. Now, Thomas Moore states that the princes were smothered with the pillows on their beds, and the names that he accounts are Sir James Tyrrell, John, forgive my pronunciation, Dighton, I believe, and Miles Forrest. Now, Tyrrell is reported to have confessed to the crime, right, in 1502 when under sentence of death for treason. Anyway, the actual text of the book, I'm going to give you the wee segment that talks about, describes the murder, says this. For Sir James Tyrrell devised that they should be murdered in their beds. To the execution whereof he appointed Miles Forrest, one of the four that kept them, a fellow flesh in murder before time. To him he joined John Dighton. About midnight, the innocent children, lying in their beds, came into the chamber and suddenly lapped them among the bedclothes, so bewrapped them and entangled them, keeping down by force the feather bed and pillows, hard unto their mouths, that within a while smothered and stifled their breath failing, they gave up to God their innocent souls into the joys of heaven, leaving to the tormentors their bodies dead in the bed, to bury them at the stair foot, meekly deep, in the ground under a great heap of stones. Creepy, huh?
That's quite heartbreaking, actually.
I know. Okay, yeah, creepy, heartbreaking at the same time, of course. So now, the certainty that the princess died in Richard's custody was, well, let's just say that contemporary English sources were much less confident of the boy's fate. Well into the Tudor era, many writers suggested that at least one of the brothers survived, right? Smuggled from the Tower across the sea or spared by their would-be murderers. It was a common concession that after murdering Edward, the big one, the big lad, let's say, the killers took pity on his younger brother, Richard. Now, there's so many theories about what happened to them, and I'm going to go into this a bit later, which I found quite exciting, actually, when I was having a look at this. But now, if we suppose that both the boys were murdered, who had murdered the two York princes? Now, Richard, unfortunately, the third, is a name that is mostly associated with the mystery of the two little princes. They do say that he had them killed as the right to the throne was stronger than his, and Shakespeare certainly decided that he had given the orders for the boys to be killed. And for anyone who's read the Richard III play, that's very made abundantly clear. And although I do think that the play is one of the best ones they've written, I completely disagree with the fact that Richard was the murderer. But the other person that is of interest is Henry Tudor, who later became Henry VII in 1485 after defeating Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. He had an even shakier claim to the throne, right? Because his claim was based on the right of conquest. There is no clear proof for either Henry or Richard to become, thought to be the murderers, but personally, I think Henry had all the more reason to kill the boys than Richard has.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. Because Richard III had declared the boys to be illegitimate, and he had strong grounds based on Elizabeth Woodville and the fact that no one wanted Edward to marry Elizabeth Woodville because she was divorced, she was a commoner, she'd married a Lancaster, all of that kind of thing. So he could have quite easily, in terms of, like, and at that point he had a son as well, so he could have quite easily have secured his claim without killing the boys, whereas, like you say, Henry Tudor, much more, like, shaky claim, and I'm pretty sure he was descended from someone who was illegitimate and was then later legitimised, so there was a lot of, like, contention as to his claim to the throne in the first place. But I don't know, have you seen The White Queen?
Yes, I love it.
It's so good. But they go with that theory that it was actually his mother, Margaret Beaufort, who organised the... and then framed Richard III for it.
Exactly. I totally
Tudors. But it reminds me of that bit in Horrible Histories about Tudor propaganda, because that's exactly what it was with, like, exactly. Shakespeare and Moore, like, because they were writing during the Tudor time to please Tudor kings, so it makes sense.
You just got this picture of Jim wandering around, was it Hampton Court Palace, singing...
I'm a nice Richard guy!
This is me, sweet Richard. Do I look like a baddie?
Amazing.
Do you know, Kelly's absolutely right, because I think immediately after Henry gained the throne, he accused Richard of cruelty and tyranny, right? But strangely and very conveniently, he didn't mention the murder of the little princes until July 1486, nearly a year after Richard's death, right? Well, I mean, I'm hoping this is true, but I definitely... read it somewhere, which makes it even more shaky for Henry. And I don't like the Tudors. I really don't like them. I think I've made my mind now. Yeah. Anyway, well, it's likely we never.
Yeah. To be they were absolute bastards. Let's not beat around the bush. However, in terms of value to the economy, love them so much.
I just don't like their characters. That was shady. Shady as fuck. Anyway, sorry. Well, likely, we will never know exactly what happened to the princes, and so this will remain, for me at least, one of the most intriguing whodunit of all time. And to be fair, when I visited the Tower of London and I went to the room where supposedly they were killed, I was reading The White Queen at the time, and I was so obsessed with the story, and I thought, I was like, I get the feels now. but maybe it was just me, you know, placebo effect. But it's really spooky if you go in. To sum up, there's four main suspects, and that, well, were thought to have killed the princes. And starting, of course, is Richard III, who is the prime suspect. He escorted Edward to the Tower of London, where he was last seen. He had an insecure hold on the monarchy due to the way he obtained the crown. He faced rebellions from the Yorkshire loyal to, sorry, Yorkists loyal to Edward IV prior to Parliament conforming him to his title to the throne of, in January 1484. I personally don't think it was him, but anywho, then we've got Henry Tudor, or Henry VII. He was Richard's rival who defeated his forces at the Battle of Bosworth. He did execute rival claimants to the throne following his coronation, or that would be his motive at least. He was out of the country, to be fair, at the time of the prince's disappearance, but he could have easily had someone else do the deed, which is my personal view. Now we've got another unlikely source that I think is nothing to do with the princes, but he was suspected at the time, was Henry Stafford. He was the second Duke of Buckingham, kingmaker and breaker. He played a major role in the rise and fall of Richard III, and he did hold a claim to the throne through the House of Beaufort family. But again, not much evidence there to suggest that he's a suspect. And then, of course, we've got Sir James Tyrrell. He was an English knight, loyal servant to Richard III, and he would be following the orders of King Richard III if he indeed, as was he confessed later on, killed the boys. And well, to be fair, he did confess under torture to the murder of the princess. So, do we believe that? Anyway, to just close the segment in terms of like who done it. I think I've read somewhere, I'm not sure if this is currently true, that Queen Elizabeth II currently will not permit any other examination of the bodies or the skeletons that were found using modern forensic testing methods, which I think is quite sad because it might lead to more truths or more evidence.
Yeah,
I don't know what you have.
especially because they found Richard III's skeleton, so they could compare, like,
Exactly, right?
surely, yeah, it's
Yes.
Yeah, but I think I wonder if it's maybe, obviously, never having met her, couldn't say, but I wonder if it's maybe on religious grounds. These are children, so it's not like an adult. These are children, and children always emote a different response than an adult. Whether that's right or wrong is irrelevant. So I wonder if it's that, and plus as well. Then you'll look at them, and it won't end the speculation. So even if we find out that these are the princes, although you would also have to test the DNA of somebody in the royal family as well. But even if you find out, you know, oh yes, these definitively are the princes in the tower, then it goes to, okay, right, so this is how they died. They've got, I don't know, dents here, or there's evidence of poison or whatever. But then you go on to, well, who did it? Who done it? So it won't actually solve the problem. The how do you solve a problem like the princes in the tower? I don't know. That's what I think anyway. I don't know.
Well, if anything, like Charles is always up for getting his DNA hangs. Like he gave his DNA for the Romanov family skeletons getting found. That's how they
Ooh,
discovered
that's another
Anastasia and
one.
Alexei.
We know that wasn't really Anastasia because, you know, she then ended up in a Disney film, so.
Well, of
Oh,
course.
I love that movie.
It is such a good movie.
Yes. But see, like about Richard, I just think he's brilliant. I love Richard the Third. I think I just adore him. And anyway, he's just like my personal opinion. I am a fan of Richard the Third. And you know what's really striking is that, I mean, if you look at Elizabeth Woodville, the mother of the princes, right? She sent her daughters into out of sanctuary and into Richard the Third's care in spring 1484. So, would you really think that he's this guy has murdered her sons if she had sent her daughters there, right? It's just like, you know, it's a bit spooky that she never accused him openly, right?
Yeah.
Because none of those closest to Richard, sorry, to the princes, made accusations against Richard III. And she, Elizabeth, she lived until 1492, but never once accused Richard of their murder. And their sister, like her daughter, Elizabeth of York, was queen until her death in 1503. And even when she had her own dynasty to protect, she, like her sisters, she remained silent on the fate of the brothers. So that, for me, if the mother and the sisters of the princes were like, well, they never voiced any suspicion towards Richard, like, she's the mother. Would she not, like, want to, you know, protect the reputation of her kids? Would she not want to go after the murderer? Would she actually remain silent and just do nothing if she thought really that Richard III was the, you know, the culprit? But at the same time, I don't know. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's...
Do you go against the king, though? Sorry.
Well, but I would say that case, she's got Henry Tudor with his big army.
But even then, though, at the same token of time, the king's authority is still, what, it's still supreme, isn't it? I mean, I get, like, perhaps, you know, Henry Tudor would have obviously, if for example, they called bullshit and went, okay, no, they did murder the kids. But what do you do, though? That's the thing, though. I mean, Becky's kind of point, going back to whodunit, etc. You know, I think that's quite a difficult situation. As much as you can say, okay, I accuse, you know, j'ai accuse. Like, what's going to happen with the outcome? Who's to say that, you know, even if with Henry Tudor with his big army, who's to say that if a battle did kind of happen, he would have won? You never know.
But then I guess you could say, like, Elizabeth Woodville lived, like, quite a bit into her daughter's reign, I'm sure. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure she did. So, like, by that time, Richard had been dead for however many years. They had their own line established. She would have nothing to gain. In fact, it probably would have been better for her to say, oh yeah, remember my uncle, Richard III, or remember my brother-in-law, Richard III? He totally killed my sons, or he totally killed my brothers. But neither of them did. Because if like they were convinced of that, then they would say it, because the guy had been dead for like 30 years, so there'd be nothing to gain from it.
And if you study Elizabeth's her life, she's always been quite of a rebel. So she was she wasn't conforming to the rules at the time, and she was quite a rebellious, like, powerful, strong, independent woman.
The way hashtag she lived her
Yeah, exactly. Hashtag queen, babe. Like, the way she lived her life, she was a divorcee. She managed to marry a king. She was quite a strong woman. And I think she wouldn't be, well, in my mind, she wouldn't be silenced. But maybe, again, this is way too innocent, and I'm not taking into account the real dynamics of the time, like, as Cameron said about the king. But yeah, I just feel she would have rebelled against the murderer of her sons. But before I finish the segment, I'd like to say that, you know, the disappearance of the two little princes, of course, was a tragedy, and it led to many rumours that at least, you know, either Richard or Henry were the murderers and culprits. But, well, the rumour has it that one of the princes at least has survived, and that is the younger prince, Richard. So there were, out of the many pretenders that came forth during the years, there were two that were the most famous ones: Lambert Sinnel and the more credible Perkin Warbeck. They both claimed to be one of the Plantagenet princes threatening the Tudor claim to the throne. Now, the Lambert Sinnel, I don't know if you've heard of this before, I hadn't actually. The Lambert Sinnel affair is traditionally remembered as an attempt to use an Oxford boy to impersonate Edward now, right? But his story never fully added up for the Yorkist plot. And what happened at the time was there was some connection to some documents in the Irish Parliament, but Henry the VII ordered all of the records of the Irish Parliament that sat in 1487 to be destroyed, meaning in my head that he might have something in those documents that surely he didn't want out in the light of day. The other case was Perkin Warbeck, which was, I urge you to go look him up. It's an incredible story. His ability to torment Henry VII for so long was a direct result of the lack of certainty that the princes were dead. And at the time, right, funny fact, Maximilian I, the Holy Roman Emperor, was unswerving and vocal in his support for Perkin as the real Richard, Duke of York, and so was our favourite James VI of Scotland. Perkin repeatedly claimed that he had three physical marks that would prove that he was Richard, Duke of York, and that the claim was never rubbished by Henry, even after Perkin's capture. So Bernard André and the Spanish ambassador Pedro de Ayala both described Perkin being bitten and disfigured gravely after his capture, which might have been to hide his features, or at least his undoubtedly Plantagenet looks, because they were very distinct. After his capture, though, he did retract his claim, writing a confession in which he said he was a Fleming born in Tournai around 1474. What the historical accounts tell us is that dealing with Warbeck cost Henry VII over £13,000, which is equivalent to many millions in today's money, putting a strain on Henry's weak state finances. That concludes sort of my section, and it was quite brief, but it just gives you lots to think about. Who did murder the princes? Were they both dead? Were the guys that emerged after the princes, or like one of the princes, probably Richard of York?
I'm still sticking with my theory that Henry Tudor was involved in it. He's shady.
Yes. He spent £13,000 to, like, you know, while he was dealing with a Warbeck story. That must mean something.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
But yeah, Princess in the Tower, I, like, look it up. It's just, like, a tragedy, but it's just so full of mystery, and it's so full of, like, interest still to this very day that, you know, there's paintings devoted to them. It's just great. Not the actual death, my God, like the story is just still quite mysterious and, yeah, interesting.
It's a shame that they both died, I mean, obviously. But again, like, kind of going back to my point I kind of made before, like, even back then, I believe they still had, is it lay majesty kind of laws? Any insult against a king or a former king, you know, was still kind of punishable. So how do you go about it, though? I don't know, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
No, two boys, like, at the end of the day, two boys were dead, and they were, like, they could have been smuggled away instead of being, like, killed, and they were all done so for the sake of, you know, being a king or a queen, and it's just horrendous, isn't it?
It really is.
But I think that happened, I mean, not just, obviously, in England, but it happened across the whole of the medieval world. I'm sure there were instances in the Byzantine Empire as well, whereby infants, etc., were often poisoned because they had, like, a legitimate claim to the throne, and then you'd have, like, a cousin that would come along and be like, you know, boom, I'm here, make me fucking emperor or empress or something like that. I think it's just a part of kind of, like, medieval Renaissance kind of politics.
Indeed, and it's disgusting. Like, disgusting.
It is.
For me, I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not sure what I think. I don't think that it was done. If it was done by Richard III, I don't think it was done deliberately. However, sticking young children in the tower was as good as a death sentence anyway, just because of the state that it would have been in. And disease was rampant anyway. I think, Maria, as you said, you know, he'd already illegitimized them, so that he had no reason to kill them. None at all.
Exactly. And I think Richard was such a... I think he was a good guy. I really think he was a good guy. He was just misunderstood, potentially.
I was misunderstood. King Richard III.
You guys really need to watch Horrible Histories, because honestly, it's just brilliant. Thank you very much, Maria. That was really brilliant. So next up is the Lost City of Atlantis. Kelly, no pressure, but I think everybody has heard of it, although don't necessarily know much about the history of it. Yeah, when you're ready.
Yes, right. So I'm really excited to talk about this because I had so much fun looking up Atlantis. So it's a bit of a weird one because it kind of flirts between history and legend. So to kind of take it with a pinch of salt, and I think most people are kind of agreed nowadays that Atlantis in and of itself was maybe not real, but then that's where a huge lot of the mystery comes from. You know, it's like, was Atlantis ever real? I think it's more that rather than and the origins of it rather than its role, more or less. So yeah, basically to go back to the beginning, to start with the facts, if you like, of the origins of the Atlantis story, which I'll just call it the Atlantis story because yeah, there's a lot of debate as to how real it is. But basically it all came from our good friend Plato, who is the ancient Greek philosopher. So he first mentioned the island nation of Atlantis in his work Timaeus and Critias in 360 BC. Now, this is the base structure for every single other piece of literature on Atlantis. So everything we know or anything that anyone has written about Atlantis comes from this one single source from Plato. And in this work, Plato says that this work of his was based in turn on the work of someone else called Solon, who was basing his work on translations from Egyptian records that he translated while he was in Egypt. And those records in Egypt told stories of ancient Egyptian priests writing about a city of Atlantis 900, like 9,000, 10,000 years before that. So we're going back quite a long time. Now, this is like 10,000 years before Plato's time that he writes about this Atlantis that having been supposedly existed. So in this work, Plato describes Atlantis as being a powerful and advanced kingdom, which, now this is my favourite, he describes it as lying beyond the Pillars of Hercules. Now, the Pillars of Hercules, most people agree today, they think that it means the Strait of Gibraltar. Why did they change that name? Like, I vote we change that back to the Pillars of Hercules. I think that's a much cooler name.
I agree.
I mean, just saying. So essentially, if we're taking that as the Pillars of Hercules as meaning the Strait of Gibraltar, then most people have theorised that Plato was meaning it was in the Atlantic Ocean, so beyond the Strait of Gibraltar. So it describes the land and the island itself as being larger than Libya and Asia Minor put together, and in it existed, quote, a confederacy of kings of great and marvellous power who held sway over the island and many other islands surrounding it and part of the continent. Now, the story goes that Atlantis, the island, was protected by the god Poseidon. And Poseidon made his, so when Poseidon rose the island from the sea, he made his son Atlas its king. And he made it also the namesake of the island and the water around it, which is where the Atlantic Ocean comes from. So that, that exists to this day. And the story goes that as the Atlanteans grew more and more powerful, so you know they'd established an empire, they had one of the most, according to Plato, they had one of the most mightiest navies in the world. And as they grew more powerful, they began to expand towards Europe and Africa. But as they did, it's like that old saying, the more powerful they got, the more corrupt, the more greedy they got. So as they moved inwards into the Mediterranean, they began to take slaves, they began to wreak havoc in the Mediterranean and essentially got a bit too big for their boots. Now, the final straw that broke the camel's back for the Atlanteans was when they decided to attack Athens. So according to Plato, the destruction of Atlantis came about when the Atlantean navy went to attack the city of Atlantis, but the Athenians had entered into an alliance with other a lot of the I don't it doesn't say how many, but there's an alliance of Greek states essentially that were led by the Athenians that pushed the Atlanteans back, so they defeated the Atlanteans at sea, sorry. And when the Atlanteans had been pushed back to their island, the gods saw fit to punish them for their corruption. So as a punishment, they condemned Atlantis and beset it with earthquakes and floods, which sunk it beneath the ocean in, quote, a single day and night of misfortune. So essentially, they've got a bit too big for their boots. They've tried to attack Greece. The Greek gods have been like, nah, get back. So it's not even just that they were defeated. So according to Plato, they had already been defeated by the Greek states, but that wasn't enough. Basically, the Greek gods were like, nah, you know what, you need to be like submerged beneath the ocean forever for doing this. Now, whether you want to take that as like a story of, so essentially the whole reason is the debate as to whether this story was a myth or real comes from the fact that most people believe that Plato was using Atlantis as like a myth, like an allegory to highlight the consequences of hubris. So basically, like, as a cautionary tale, like, didn't get too big for your boots or this is what will happen to you, basically. But then there's also the kind of question of, was it, because it very much paints the Atlanteans as being like a rival force to the ancient Greeks. Now, it's that whole way of like, is that a way of, you know, consolidating the status of the ancient Greek powers over like rival powers? There's all of this kind of debate over that. And it was controversial even in ancient times. So Crantor, the philosopher Crantor, is said to have believed Plato and when took his word as gospel and said that Plato was talking about a real life actual event. But then Strabo and Aristotle both basically said, nah, he's just making it up. Like, it's an allegory, basically. It's very, very possible, like, to me, and I don't know what you think about this, but to me, someone pulling that out of thin air, I mean, yeah, I get it. People have nice imaginations and stuff, but that has to have come from a real-life event. Like, that has to surely have been drawn from something that actually happened that he's then embellishing to tell that story.
I'm totally with you on that one, Kelly, by the way. Sorry, yeah. Just to say that.
I was quite interested to hear your views, Media, because obviously a lot of it is, I don't know if what the kind of story of Atlantis is and is told in Greece, or if it is told in Greece at all. But, I don't...
Sorry, we do. Like, I am completely with you because we... Part of our like syllabus at school was to be taught about and analyse the Plato's Republic, and I think there's a clear distinction. So we were, when Plato wants to teach or like use it as a, as you said, like the amazing thing he said, didn't fill your boots.
Yeah,
that amazing. That, like that sums it up. I think he would have made it much clearer, like he does with the Republic, that this is an ideal state, and this is a metaphor that can teach us lessons, basically. But he never, well, at least in the Greek syllabus, that was never the case with the Atlantis story. So maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but we actually thought that Atlantis was like we potentially a real place that got buried underneath the sea. So that, I think, is a notion in Greek, that if Plato wants to teach you something, that this is something that is like, take a lesson from this, but anything else can possibly potentially be true.
Yeah, because I think that's where a lot of the interpretation for it comes from, is the fact that it doesn't say that it kind of tells it as if it actually happened. And obviously it could like embellish parts of it, but it surely must come from something, which leads me on to the theories. So the most well-known theory, or the most widely accepted theory, now this is one that I'm kind of leaning towards believing, as much as like I love the, I think I'd said it before when we'd messaged about this the other day, that part of my brain, when it comes to like unsolved mysteries and things like this, is part of my brain wants to go, right, okay, that's rational, you know, this, that, and the next thing. And then the other part of my brain is like, supernatural, like, oh my god, it was like, we can't explain it, it's a mystery, blah blah blah, aliens or like ghosts or whatever. But yeah, the most widely accepted theory for the source of the Atlantis story is they think that Plato might have been drawing this from the ancient island of Thera, I think that's how you pronounce it, Thera, which is now known as Santorini, and the modern Greek island is Santorini. So basically, in the second millennium BC, the kingdom of Thera was, or so it is written, was half submerged by a tsunami, which was caused by a volcanic eruption, which is said to have destroyed the Minoan civilization. Now, the Minoan civilization descended from King Midas, apparently, or you know, the Midas touch myth in Greek mythology. So, they believe that that is what destroyed the civilization on Crete that was descended from him. So they think that that is most commonly agreed as being where Plato might have drawn inspiration, or it might have kind of used that and then to inform his story of Atlantis, basically. I don't know. I mean, there's a few other ones kind of going, a few other theories as it gets later and later, but that's the more contemporary description of it. I don't know if anyone...
Absolutely.
I mean...
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds... That sounds like the most rational one.
Yeah. Exactly. And as you said, the Therians or the Santorinians were supposed to be quite... quite advanced in the way they used, you know, from like the how do you call that, like WC system, to put it like the loo system they had. They were quite advanced, yeah. So I think that's why the Atlanteans were thought to be an advanced sort of like people, and so were the Therians. So I think it's a very good valid point and connection there also. Kel has mentioned like the big explosion. Pictures, if you could just see pictures of the hidden thingy, the hidden part of land that's now underneath the water, is so eerie. Like, have a look, Google it, just a satellite picture of Santorini at the moment, and you can clearly see a part missing, which is underwater, which I think is like, wow, almost like this is Atlantis.
I'm definitely looking that up. That sounds so chilling.
Yes.
Because Santorini's beautiful. Santorini's, is that not where they filmed, this is totally off topic, but is that not where they filmed Mamma Mia?
I think they have.
Or did I make that up?
Santorini.
It's the place with the beautiful
blue
roofs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite unique. I think that was Skopelos where they filmed Mamma Mia. But if you want to portray a Greek island, the first thing you show is Santorini, because it's a classic white and blue and the wee churches and the you know, the sunset and the sunrise, blah blah blah. But rumor has it, if you want to test your relationship, you go to Santorini, because it turns out like you either break up on the spot or you get married. For us singletons out there, I'm just saying.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Atlantean history.
That definitely said, like, I mean, I mean that's the theory I think that I'm going with. I think that that sounds most plausible as being the origin of Atlantis. But there is some other theories. Now, some of these might get you enraged, trust me, when it gets to the modern period. I mean, right. So, to begin with, so moving on from the theory that Plato was drawing from the eruption that submerged Thera, there was also early Christians had kind of mixed views as to whether Atlantis was real or not. So some of them believed that it was a myth and some of them believed that it was real. But a guy called Cosmos Antiopleses, I've totally butchered the guy's name, but he believed that it was real and that it was proof that the Earth was flat, because it said that beyond the island of Atlantis, that is where the Earth ended, basically. So, yeah, we'll take that as you will. In the 16th century, philosophers, so with the discovery of the quote-unquote New World, when the America started being colonised, philosophers started to equate the New World with Atlantis. So they thought that when Plato was talking about Atlantis, it was actually describing the New World like long, long, long before it was discovered. And a guy called Janus Johannes Bercherod actually said Orbe Novo Non Novo, which means the New World is not new. So he essentially believed that America was Atlantis, basically, which I'm a bit like, I mean, it's plausible, but I don't know about that. Like, yeah, anyway. So then there was also another theory that people began to think that the Mayan and Aztec ruins could be remnants of Atlantis as well. Now, you're going to like the complete opposite end of the world by this point, you know. Plato was writing in ancient Greece and now suddenly we're over in like Mexico, and like this is where it starts to kind of become more and more kind of people embellishing it for their own agendas, basically. So people essentially started saying during the colonial height of colonial period that the remnants that they discovered, so like the Spanish and English and whatever settlers, when they encountered the ruins of the Maya and the Aztec, basically. Now, this is completely 100% down to racism and colonialism, as most things are, but they believed the belief of those as being remnants of Atlantis comes from the Europeans, who essentially thought that the inferior indigenous people, who they believed to be completely incapable of building such amazing architectural wonders, they believed that that was impossible, and a master, like a more advanced race, had to have been responsible for like telling them how to do that, or at least, or to have constructed it for them.
Aliens.
Yeah, exactly. But it is literally purely stems from the fact that the Europeans came over, encountered something that they didn't understand, and basically went, you know what, these people are too inferior to have built this themselves. It has to have been an ancient European, like, master race. But yeah, that's a whole other nasty, but then it gets worse. Then when you move into the 1800s, there's an American congressman called Ignatius Donnelly, who theorised in 1882 that all ancient civilizations descended from Atlantis. Now, this one is a bit more fantastical, a bit more out there, but I respect this guy's, like, you know, he's going with a theory that is a theory. Do you know what I mean? He's not, like, half-assing it. And I'm like, you know what? Fair play to you. So he believes that, like, all ancient civilizations descend from Atlantis. And he believes that the proof of this is the fact that there's, you know, there's a common similarity between all of the ancient mythologies and their creation stories. So you've got, like, similarities between Greek mythology, Nordic mythology, ancient Egyptian mythology. They all share similar components. And he believed that that common denominator was Atlantis, and that they were all descended from Atlantis. And it also believed that Atlantis, the island of Atlantis, was the site of the Garden of Eden, and that it was destroyed in the Great Flood, which is described in the Bible. So, I mean, as theories go, it's a pretty, you know what I mean? If you want to do a theory, at least make it exciting, I guess.
I like that one too. It's impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's just went out there, like, you know, fair play.
You know, it's nice when, like, the theories touch upon, like, real-life facts, like, oh, this is a natural disaster, let's tie up with a theory. It makes it even more plausible.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then he's just thought, you know, there's loads of things that I can tie this to, and it makes sense. I mean, because I've always wondered, you know, there is similarities between all of the ancient cultures, and it does make you think how, but I mean, realistically, it's probably more the fact that they were able to communicate with each other, and we just don't know how they communicated with each other. There's maybe been, like, travelling people that have went between them or whatever, rather than it being, like, an external kind of force. But as far as deities go, it's not totally, like, it's one of the more out there ones that isn't completely out there, if you know what I mean. And then the last one is just disgusting, and no one will be surprised at all to hear this. So in around 1900, the German Aristophic movement began to look at the stories of Atlantis and essentially create their own version of the story, and in this they said that the Atlanteans were a race of Hyperborean Nordic supermen who originated in northern Europe, and they were the race from which the Aryan master race was descended. And they used this propaganda essentially in contrast to Jewish people, so the Jewish people were not descended from the Atlantean, like, Hyperborean super race. And then when the Nazis came to power in the 1930s, Heinrich Himmler actually enshrined this theory in their doctrine. So actually in the Nazi doctrine is that the Aryan master race is descended from the Hyperborean Nordic supermen, also known as Atlanteans. This is actually completely in opposition to every single ancient account of Atlantis, which is most accounts describe them as being non-Caucasian. So the fact that they've just took that and just went, you know what? They're absolute, like, they're Aryan supermen. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
The Nazis did that a lot, believe it or not. So one of the interesting things Nazis like to do in terms of their racial theory was to try and link it with other great ancient civilizations and try and make it kind of like German, like Germanize it. And one of the things that they did with the ancient Greeks, and I believe also the ancient Romans as well, was try and say that the Greeks and the Romans originally either developed from great noble German kind of stock, and that's how they were able to, you know, essentially become the ancient superpowers that they were. And interestingly enough, they also kind of tied this in with the whole Aryan kind of theory as well, saying that basically that in kind of like in India and in Iran, that the reason why the kind of like the Persians certainly were such a great kind of species of people and how they had such a great empire was essentially because they were, you know, superhuman, super blonde Germans, essentially. That's kind of what they said.
Wow.
I mean, come on.
Listen, that's their bullshit. I mean,
exactly.
Most people,
to you, yes. Like, it's funny because it's like the stupid Greek people. Oh God, the stupid Greek people today that say, "Yes, we, the descendants of Plato and Aristotle." And I'm like, you know what? We've been occupied by the Ottomans for 500 years. How likely are you that you're not like a bit of a? Do you know what I mean? Like, calm the fuck on.
Oh, some people though, they'll just jump on anything. But that's like such a prime example though of them, of how people can take advantage of like myths and history and stories to like manipulate it to their own advantage, which yeah, that's a whole other like level of ugly right there. But yeah, that is what they did with the story of Atlantis. So believe it or not, I mean, when I think Atlantis, I don't know about you, but I just think about, you know, like the Disney movie and, you know, lost cities and submerged underworld mystery. I never thought that the Nazis would have used it as part of their master race plan, but there you go, they somehow managed it. But yeah, so those were the main kind of uses and theories behind the Atlantis story. But now, this is just to finish my wee thing up. Now, a huge, huge part of the debate around Atlantis is locations. So people believe that, so there's been loads of speculation as to if Atlantis existed, whereabout in the world did it exist, and what remnants are there of it now. And obviously I mentioned a wee bit before about Thera, or modern day Santorini, which is the most widely accepted theory as to the location of a real life explosion, whether that was Atlantis or not, you know, is up for debate. But the source of the story for Atlantis anyway. But Atlantis itself has been speculated to have existed on the following range of sites. Now, like, yeah. So basically the most common the commonly discussed, as I mentioned before, is the Greek islands, so like Santorini, Crete, and then also Mediterranean islands as well. So you've got Sardinia, Sicily, Cyprus, Malta, as well as land-based places like Troy was believed to have been the site of it at one point, Tartessos, Israel, and Northwest Africa. So that's the sort of Mediterranean locations that people have thought that it might exist. There's also the Atlantic Ocean, which is where Plato, or most people believe that Plato describes it as being in his work, as being beyond the Strait of Gibraltar. So in the Atlantic Ocean, they've posited the Canary Islands, the Madeira Islands, the Faroe Islands, as well as the submerged island of Spartel, which is just near the Strait of Gibraltar, although they're kind of putting doubt on that one as to whether that was big enough to even support human beings living on it. But yeah, and then also there's been some theories about Northern Europe. So one of these is called, I don't know if any of you have heard of this, but the Doggerland. Has anyone heard of the Doggerland?
Yes.
What is it?
So the Doggerland was an ancient land bridge that connected Britain to mainland Europe. So it was before Britain split apart and floated away to be an island.
That would have been so convenient, by the way.
They've got evidence. I think they found evidence at the bottom of the channel that there was like civilization there at one point. So that's kind of where that's came from. Also off the coast of Ireland and Spain, so Andalusia, Cadiz, and then also Sweden, as we know from Nazi accounts. Yeah. And then finally, they also believe that it could be in the Bermuda Triangle, the Bahamas, Indonesia, and then also Antarctica. So this theory basically posited that there was a big massive island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which was Atlantis. And because of like seismic whatever, the big massive island travelled south, down through into the South Atlantic Ocean, and then was submerged underneath Antarctica. And it exists underneath the icy shelves of of Antarctica to this day. So, I mean, in terms of narrowing it down, you've got pretty much the whole world apart from Australia there.
Exactly, all the islands for Australia, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I think realistically, part of me wants to believe that, you know, they're like a mystical, like underwater, like in the Disney movie where they like live in a bubble underwater and they power their ships with crystals and stuff. But then my rational part of my brain is like, nah, it is probably like Thera. It's probably been the submerged part of Santorini. And not that it was Atlantis itself, but it was that he made up Atlantis but drew it from that real life historical event. Yeah, don't know. Does anyone else have any strong feelings on?
Can I just say, I mean, if the Nazis are getting, like, superhuman blonde people, I definitely think, Kelly, you and I, we can go with the assumption that magic crystals truly powered Atlantis.
Well, yeah, that is true. They would probably buy into that, so yeah. But yeah, so that concludes my my whirlwind tour of the Lost City of Atlantis. Myth, history, I guess we'll never know.
Thank you very much, Kelly. That was brilliant. So now we head on to my segment. Firstly, I want to say Dankeschön to Kelly for the brilliant idea for this week's podcast, because I love it. Today, I am going to be talking about the lost colony of Roanoke in what is now North Carolina. I imagine that our one listener might not know too much about the earliest history of the British in America, other than having heard of Jamestown. Many people, Cam included, as I discovered earlier, think that Jamestown was the first settlement in Virginia, but that's absolutely not the case. The first settlement was Roanoke, but you could argue that Jamestown was the first permanent settlement. Anyway, now, when we're talking about Roanoke, when I was doing my research, I've kind of, for ease, divided it into three distinct periods in Roanoke's English history, and we're going to be visiting all of them. Anyone who has ever looked at the history of Roanoke knows that the timeline is a bit ridiculous, so I do apologise in advance, but please bear with me as I explain the fascinating history of the Lost Colony before we delve into the myriad of possible explanations for the disappearance of the settlers. And, Kelly, just for you, I have found a conspiracy theory.
Yes!
I thought you might enjoy that. So, timeline. Now, it's the late 16th century, and Europeans have been aware of the existence of the Americas for less than 100 years. The Spanish at this point have a sizable presence in Spanish Florida, the south coast of America, Mexico, parts of South America and the Caribbean, whereas England are lagging behind significantly. To combat this, in 1584, Queen Elizabeth I of England grants a charter to Sir Walter Raleigh, the famous explorer, giving him the rights to all territory in the New World north of Spanish Florida but south of Newfoundland. Now, this is a big deal, encompassing thousands of square miles with potentially limitless opportunities to make money. Aside from colonisation, his charter came with two expectations: to provide riches for the crown and to provide a base from which to attack and disrupt Spanish treasure ships and trade. That's a lot harder to say than you would think it would be. That same year, Raleigh sent an expedition to the Americas to investigate and identify a suitable place to colonise. And this is the first, albeit short, period in Roanoke's European history. The expedition found the island known as Roanoke in what is now North Carolina, which at the time was held by the Roanoke tribe, who are, and apologies if I say this wrong, a Secotan allied tribe. After 6 weeks of exploration, establishing relations with all of the local tribes, the expedition returned to Blighty to report to Good Queen Bess, and they brought with them two Native Americans, Wanchez, who was the chief of the Roanoke tribe, and Manteo, who was the chief of the local Croatoan tribe. And Manteo in particular is going to be very, very important in the history of Roanoke. Now, they were brought back to England to assist the explorers in reporting on the conditions of the Roanoke area and on the local tribes. Both chiefs, when presented to court, were a complete sensation, and Manteo in particular was a hit in the Elizabethan court. Later on, when the two returned to Roanoke, Wanchez rejected the friendship of the English. Pretty wise, to be honest with you. Whereas Manteo continued friendly relations with the settlers. As an interesting aside, Manteo later became the first Native American to be baptised into the Church of England.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there we go. So, 1585 begins the second period in Roanoke's history and is the first permanent Bunny Ears settlement. Now, 600 people left England to go to what was then called Virginia, including Manteo and Wanchez, but only 107 colonists actually arrived or settled in the new colony for one reason or another. But most importantly for the settlers, they arrived with far fewer provisions than they had planned for due to lost ships, desertion, battles, whatever. This meant that initially the settlers were heavily dependent on the native tribes, which would have been fine, except that the settlers almost immediately clashed with the local Secotoan tribes, accusing them of stealing a silver cup. Now, the leader of that expedition, who was Richard Grenville, decided that a proportionate response was due to the Native Americans for the supposed theft of this silver cup. and razed the Native American village to the ground and assassinated their leader.
Standard.
Yeah. Grenville returned to England at the end of that year, and he promised to return with supplies. They were desperate at this stage. In the meantime, the settlers had to try and trade with the neighbouring tribes that they hadn't pissed off, a need which had a deadly effect on the Native American population, because the Europeans, the English, they spread disease along their trading routes, and the Native American population didn't have the same kind of, I suppose, immunity, tolerance to the diseases that the English were carrying than the English did. So this would have been catastrophic. The next year, in 1586, Sir Francis Drake arrived to provide some much needed provisions, but he actually ended up taking the settlers back to England. They'd had enough, they were starving, they were hungry, they were pissed off, and they just had enough. Grenville actually arrived back at Roanoke pretty soon after that. And when he spoke to the local friendly tribes, he learnt of the colony's desertion. He then turned round and headed back to England to pick up new settlers, but he left a group of 15 men to maintain the English claim to Virginia. And this here is the end of the second period of Roanoke's European history. So far, not great, but fairly straightforward. The next year after that, in 1587, Raleigh sent a new expedition to Virginia to found the city of Raleigh in what is now Chesapeake Bay. That's not at all self-obsessed. The expedition stopped by Roanoke, and the original plan was that they would speak to the people in Roanoke, get the lay of the land, learn about the local friendly tribes, that kind of a thing that would help them. But when they arrived in the settlement, they found only one skeleton and an overgrown, abandoned settlement. The fleet commander refused to take the new settlers on to Raleigh and instead ordered them to stay in Roanoke. And this begins the third and final period in the settlement's history. And it quickly became clear that relations with the local tribes continued to be crap, and the colony were again in a desperate situation. And this is a recurring theme, to be honest with you, even with Jamestown as well for the first while. The new governor, John White, was persuaded to travel back to Blighty to ask for help and to get more supplies, and he left behind 90 men, 17 women, and 11 children. Sadly for these new inhabitants, John White returned safely to England, but he was delayed for 3 years, firstly by crap weather, and then the Anglo-Spanish War and the myriad of Spanish armadas. I cannot imagine the desperate feeling they must have all had. It must have been absolutely horrendous. 3 years later, in 1590, John White finally arrived back in Virginia, and this is where the famous mystery occurs. As the rescuers waded onto the beach, they spotted the letters CRO carved onto a tree on the beach, and they reached the settlement and saw the word Croatoan carved onto a wooden pole, which was part of a defensive palisade. Inside the palisade, everything, and I mean everything, was gone. There was nothing. No people, no animals, no buildings, nothing. There was no sign of any settlement bar the palisade. Now, Croatoa was part of a prearranged code that John White had agreed with the settlers before he returned home. If the settlers had to abandon the island, they would carve their intended destination into a tree or a pole or something to let him know where they had gone. And if a cross was added at the end, this would mean that the settlers left in an emergency. In this instance, there was no cross at the end. Now, if you remember, Croatoa was the name of an indigenous people who lived around 50 miles south of the settlement. One of their members, Manteo, had lived with and helped the English settlers and had made the trip to London to visit Elizabeth I's court. When he came back to Roanoke, Manteo had been living as part of the settlement, and he acted as a sort of ambassador between the English settlers and the Native American tribes. John White initially planned to head along the coast to the Croatoan tribe to confirm the survival of the settlers. However, there were a series of delays and a lack of provisions, and he was forced back to England. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because several historians have argued that White didn't consider the disappearance of the settlers to be an issue because the prearranged code had been used. So he went back to England, where shortly thereafter he snuffed it. And that, my friends, is the end of the third and final chapter in Roanoke's history. So there is an added mystery to the main mystery. And although, Kelly, this is not the conspiracy theory, I do think you are going to like this. Now, just a little bit of background. The mystery and obsession around Roanoke is actually really more of a modern invention. In 1534, a historian by the name of George Bancroft published a Brobdingnagian history of the US, which is, for me, quite surprising, considering at that point it had only been around for about the length of a fart, but there we have it. Bancroft made Roanoke into a magical, mysterious, and incredibly romanticized story. And this is because his tale of Roanoke included the story of Virginia Dare, whose importance in the annals of history lies in the fact that she was the first person of English ancestry to be born in what would become the United States. There was also, by the by, a little boy that was married born a couple of days later, but we don't know anything about him at all, which is kind of sad for him.
He's like the Buzz Aldrin of this story.
Yes, he is. He is so the Buzz Aldrin of the story. So Virginia Dare was also Governor John White's granddaughter. As a political entity and a propaganda tool, she was living proof of the claim the English had to the Virginia colonies. Bancroft's history of the US helped propel Virginia into a kind of like a Victorian celebrity almost. And she was the face of so many things during the mid to late 1800s and even further on into more modern age. In fact, the Medoc Vineyard produced Virginia Dare wine, which is apparently really, really sweet, all the way from the late 1800s through Prohibition and right up to the 60s when the winery closed down, until the rights to the wine were bought by Francis Ford Coppola, and now Francis Ford Coppola makes Virginia Dare wine, which I think is really cool. Yeah, there's a quote from her on the website and everything. That's really cool and really random.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay, so now I've kind of done that aside, I'd like to discuss the possible reasons for the disappearances and where the settlers might have gone. And we obviously don't have time to get into the serious details, so I'm only going to focus on a few of them and some fun ones as well. So, option one, starvation. I am going to argue here that this option is the most obvious because John White returned to England to gather further supplies to try and ensure the success of the settlement, even if he was delayed by 3 years. And the settlers, when they arrived, didn't have much of an awareness of the local area, particularly as they weren't planning on being there in the first place. And so they didn't necessarily know where the best hunting grounds were or what was safe to eat. They also had to be careful to avoid land held by the Native American tribes that either they or the previous settlement had pissed off. And probably as well, although I'm not, this is not my area of expertise, so I couldn't say for sure, but I would imagine the conservation of as much ammunition as possible for protection purposes, particularly as time went on, because they had no idea when or even if White was going to return to them. Even if this is perhaps the most obvious one, it wouldn't explain the lack of bodies or the removal of the buildings. I've seen elsewhere, everybody's heard of this, 20-ish years after Roanoke, the settlers at Jamestown had to resort to cannibalism to stay alive. One historian I was reading suggested that it is possible that the people of Roanoke could have been hungry enough for cannibalism to be a viable option, but it wouldn't explain where all of the bodies went, and they haven't found any bodies anywhere around that settlement. So I'm not convinced by that particular part of the theory, but it is interesting, so I thought I'd throw it in. Option two, they were killed or kidnapped by local tribes. Now, the fact that the word Croatoan was carved into a defensive palisade put up after White's departure is a sign that at some point settlers had prepared for an attack. Now, given the discord between the settlers and the local tribes, I mean, you can't blame the local tribes, it's not, I don't think, unreasonable to suggest that it was put up to defend the colony against retaliatory attacks by Native American tribes. And forgive me a minute for mentioning Disney, but John Smith, who the real-life leader of the Jamestown colony, who was famously played with a, quite frankly, shocking un-English accent by Mel Gibson in Pocahontas, tried in 1607 to discover what happened at Roanoke. And he claimed that the chief of the Powhatan tribe told him that he killed the people of Roanoke as part of a tribal feud. He also produced evidence to support his story, and in 1609, our old friend James VI I and his royal council officially blamed Powhatan and his tribe for the missing colonists. Smith also heard tales of mass slaughter and an enslaved young maid, potentially Virginia Dare, circulated in London and Jamestown. But search parties never found any physical proof of the colonists' fate, and there's no archaeological evidence of a massacre, and no bodies have been discovered at the site. So, you know, perhaps as unlikely as anything else. Option three, they were killed by the Spanish. England and Spain were in the middle of a war when the people of Roanoke disappeared, and this delayed John White's return to the colony significantly. Spain had a significant presence in Florida during this period, and some historians have posited that the Spanish travelled north and liquidated the colony. I don't think this is an option, because the Spanish were still looking for Roanoke in 1600, 10 years after the colonists went missing, so I'm not convinced. Option four, they tried to sail back to England or elsewhere, but got lost on the way. I'm instantly going to rule out heading back to Blighty, because they weren't sailors and nobody is that bloody stupid. It is possible, I think, that they might have built some form of boat or raft and sailed elsewhere up or down the coast towards another friendly settlement. But that surely would have been recorded in the records of the settlers' new home. So, again, not sure about that one. Now, option five, they went to live with the Croatoa tribe or another Native American tribe. For me, this one is the most likely. When White returned to the colony, it had been completely dismantled carefully, and there was no rushing involved that they could see. The settlers had used the pre-arranged code to indicate where they were heading to, and John White clearly thought that this is what happened. There is an added factor here, which I haven't yet discussed. White had a daughter and a granddaughter on the island. That granddaughter was Virginia Dare. Purely from a 21st century viewpoint, I can't imagine not doing everything in your power to look after your family. And I think if you truly feared for their safety, I can't imagine there would be anything on earth that would have stopped him from trying to find them. Jamestown settler Francis Nelson in 1607 drew the Zuniga map, which documents the local townships, the local Native American tribes and whatnot. On this map, it documents four men who say that they were originally from the Roanoke settlement, who were living amongst the Iroquois tribe. And there's all sorts of evidence, anecdotally, in various other places about blonde-haired, blue-eyed Native Americans, Native Americans claiming that they had white ancestors. So it's completely, you know, within the realms of possibility. Since 2013, archaeological digs in an area that's thought to have been the home of that particular Croatoa tribe have unearthed a variety of old world objects mixed in with Native American artifacts, including a rapier, the barrel of a gun, a lead shot, and a drawing slate and a lead pencil. And although these items don't prove that there was a settlement on Croatoan and they could have got there another way, we're never going to find out, because the likelihood is that any relevant settlement is underwater by now, because there's been quite a lot of coastal erosion in that area over the last however many hundred years. So it's really sad. Moving on, and I think I quite like this one out of the next two. So please bear with me. Option six, witchcraft. Much like the American Horror Story series around Roanoke, witches have been accused of being the reason behind the strange disappearance. Either witches in the woods or the Croatoan tribe executing the settlers as witches. Now, the Croatoan definition of witches were people who used black magic, not the chocolates, to commit evil in everyday life. There's no evidence that the Croatoan tribe made any such accusations, but they were known for condemning outsiders that they considered dangerous. And I think we can all agree that the European settlers were dangerous. The diseases that the English settlers spread throughout the local tribes had a deadly effect, and it's possible that the tribe blamed the settlers for evil. Am I convinced? No, not really, but it's very interesting. And the final option that I'm going to talk about today, and my personal favourite, is a supernatural explanation.
Yeah!
One of the Croatoan beliefs is that there was a spirit on the island of Roanoke which had the power to absorb humans into the landscape. And if the spirit became offended, it would turn people into trees, animals, stones, fishes, whatever, you know. The actions of the settlers of Roanoke could well have angered the spirits, and therefore it's possible that their disappearance wasn't so much a disappearance as them being reclaimed by nature.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
I know, right?
So they're just a bunch of trees now?
Possibly, yes. Although probably not now. They're probably now part of a house somewhere.
Or a park bench.
And now for my favourite bit and the last bit of my talk, the conspiracy theory. I've gone through this quite quickly, and that's because I found something when I was doing my research that I just needed to share with you all. I found a Croatoan conspiracy theory, and I am so excited. I'm going to preface this final segment by saying I don't believe a bloody word of any of it, and having looked, I cannot prove any of these, and actually I can disprove one of them. But whoever made these up, I love them. So, just to recap, the word Croatoan was found carved into the palisade at the abandoned Roanoke settlement. But this word, it seems, also has connections with other mysterious happenings over the centuries. So, mysterious happening number one. Right before he died, Edgar Allan Poe disappeared for a short time. When he re-emerged, delirious and on his deathbed, one of his last words was allegedly Croatoan, and he obsessively called out the name Reynolds. We don't know where he went when he disappeared. His official cause of death is unknown, and his medical records have been lost, so we don't know what happened to him or why he might have said it, but I checked the lists of Roanoke settlers for the name Reynolds, and there was no one on the list with the name Reynolds. The list isn't exhausted, but it would have been great if that had worked out. Mysterious happening number two. In 1888, the stagecoach robber Black Bart carved the word into the wall of his cell before he was released from prison. He was never seen or heard from again. Mysterious happening number three. The word Croatoan was found in Amelia Earhart's journal just after she disappeared in 1937. Mysterious happening number four. Croatoan was written on the last page of the logbook of the ship Carol A. Deering when it crashed on Cape Hatteras near Croatoan Island in 1921. The ship was missing its entire crew and they never found out what happened. And with those possible goosebumps, that is the end of my segment.
I like that. I like the it being the foreboding of doom down the centuries.
Right. me personally...
It's good.
Thank you. What I think probably most likely happened is that they ran out of food, ran out of really, they basically feared for their lives and went along and basically merged with the Croatoan tribes or other local tribes. Was there something sinister? I don't know, but I like to think that something positive happened. Anybody have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's that same thing, like the rational versus, like, rationally, I know they've probably just went and merged with, like, the local tribes. That seems to be the most rational, plausible explanation. But then on the other hand, I'm like, I hear, like, theories about, like, people write, like, the word, and, you know, what you were saying about, like, it being in Amelia Earhart's journal and it being this, the next thing, and it just makes me think, like,
there could be some sinister supernatural thing going on. Yeah.
There's like sinister workings, like everything's connected, like, and I feel like that's more exciting and I just kind of want to go down that route, but yeah.
I don't know, when I was reading up on this and I was looking at American Horror Story in Roanoke, and it was because I don't watch scary things because I'm a total wimp, but the synopsis on Wikipedia, which as we know is a bastion of truthfulness, was saying that the settlers in Roanoke somehow died and came back and haunted the Native American peoples, and the Native American peoples banished them by saying the word Croatoan, and that would perhaps explain all of these conspiracy theories, because these people are being haunted by spirits and are therefore writing the word Croatoan to banish the evil spirits that are haunting them. I have no idea if that's actually the case. I'm probably putting two and two together and getting 54, but, you know, why not?
I like that.
I think, kind of going back to kind of Kelly's point, where you just kind of said there, Kelly, I think probably what happened was they ran out of food, as you said as well, Becky, to be fair. They probably ran out of food, didn't have anything, and then in all likelihood they maybe went to one of the local Native American tribes and just kind of said, listen, can you help us out? And then they've been like, yeah, okay, that's fine, we'll share. And then they've just integrated, and that's been it. Or, as you know, you mentioned before, possibly they didn't want to speak to the Native American tribes and just thought, you know what, they won't help us, maybe try to go somewhere else and maybe just perished.
Possibly. I mean, I like to think that that's what happened. And for the sake of the podcast, that's what we'll say it happened. But, yeah, I don't think we're ever going to know, and that really annoys me. But people get... I was reading up on this, and what I found quite funny was there was one... I think it was the New York Times, maybe, that was talking about this. And they started it by saying, yes, this mystery, which has haunted people in both America and the UK for hundreds of years. And I'm like, not really.
The first time I did hear about it, to be fair, was when I watched American Horror Story.
Well, to be fair, the first time I heard about it was watching that Sleepy Hollow series.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that, because yeah, that's the good one, because he says that they speak Middle English, so they can't understand them. That's, yes, like the one bit of historical accuracy.
Yes, I know, right? That's really... And I sat there and I thought, do you know what? This is such... Apologies to any American listeners. Such an Americanism that because it's important in America, it's important everywhere else. That's not the case. Yeah. Well, anyway, but thank you very much for listening to mine. And Cam, I believe that we will be moving on to yours now.
Yes. So, just to kind of give you a little bit of background, me and one of my old friends, we used to kind of like chat about history, and we used to kind of say, you know, like, what if, you know, what if, like, for example, the Romans and the Chinese had actually met, you know, which empire would have won? And I thought that I would kind of do my segment on the possibility of Roman legions, or Roman legionnaires, I should say, actually fighting against the Chinese. So, to start off, I'm just going to do a little bit of a timeline. I'm going to give you a little bit of information about it. I'm going to keep it brief. So, the Romans in the first century before kind of Christ were one of the fastest kind of growing empires around. Now, despite the fact that there had been civil wars, for example, between Julius Caesar and Pompey, and Octavian and Mark Antony, they still kind of dominated the scene. So, in 56 BC, there was the first triumvirate, I think that's how you say it, between Caesar, Crassus and Pompey. Now, in 56 BC, Crassus and Pompey jointly served as consuls. And following his second consulship, I should actually use his full name, sorry, Marcus Licinius Crassus, Crassus was appointed as the governor of Roman Syria. Now, Pompey had already had numerous victories. Caesar was in Gaul at this time, so Marcus Licinius Crassus, despite the fact that he had actually beat Spartacus, which I thought was very interesting, he decided himself that he would, you know, kind of, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to see if I can, you know, expand the empire myself. So he decided to go even further east, and he decided to extend the Roman Empire into modern day kind of like Iran, going into kind of Iraq, and he was going to be fighting one of the greatest empires as well that was ever known, the Parthians. So basically what happened was is he got as far as the modern day settlement of Harran, which is in southeast Turkey, before he was met by a Parthian army under a fella by the name of Serena. Now, Crassus was very, very confident that his legions would be able to kind of make quick work of the Parthians, so he was a little bit too cocky, and basically he started to push forward thinking victory would be easy because, you know, he was fighting against these eastern inferior barbarians. Now, tough shit for him, he was sadly mistaken, as the Parthians were an effective, semi-professional army with some of the most elite horse archers the world had ever seen at the time. So the legionaries were just kind of stuck there in their testudo formations, and the Parthians just kind of went, you know what, fuck it, we'll just wait until you put down your shields and then we'll just fucking pelt you. So, in a slaughter known as the Battle of Carrhae, or Carrhae, the Romans lost nearly their entire army and Crassus was killed. Funnily enough, him and his son were both killed, and I believe Crassus' head was, well, he was decapitated and they filled his head with gold. But, you know, fuck him. So, in terms of the legion, they believed that approximately 20,000 soldiers, 20,000 Roman soldiers, were killed. And they believe that 10,000 soldiers became prisoners of war, and this was reported by Plutarch. And interestingly enough, it was also reported that the Parthians themselves lost 38. So 20,000 to 38, well, I mean, fuck me, that's quite bad.
That's not even, is it? That's not even odds.
Yeah, that's an annihilation.
Yeah, that's a fucking bitch in that. So anyway, moving on. The Parthians, they had a practice whereby that if they had any kind of like prisoners of war, you know, captured soldiers, they would use them as border guards. So they decided that, well, it's kind of, you know, the idea behind it is they transferred the 10,000 legionaries to the eastern borders of their empire. And the reason for this was they believed that if they were in the western border, they would obviously try and escape back to Rome. So if they're in the east, well, they didn't have a fucking chance. So most likely, if this is the case, 10,000 legionaries would have been transported to the eastern fringes of the Parthian Empire and would have to have kind of accepted, you know, basically their new lot in life. Now, this is actually quite interesting, and I kind of found out was one of the most eastern kind of like parts of the Parthian Empire was a place called Merv or Alexandria Margiana, which is now in modern day Turkmenistan. So this is the part that I kind of had a little bit of difficulty with as well. So records of these soldiers basically kind of like just kind of seem to disappear for the better part of about 17 years until the battle of, I think it's Zizi, which was fought basically by the Chinese. So Chinese had the Han Empire, actually. So the Chinese, the Han Empire, had a general by the name of Chen Tang, who assaulted a border town known today as Taraz in 36 BC, which is located in Kazakhstan near the border of Kyrgyzstan. So it is actually quite possible that these soldiers, or these 10,000 legionaries, may have actually ended up fighting or protecting the border against the Han Chinese. Now, this is the part that I found really interesting. So there's been Chinese historians that have noted that defenders of this settlement, they held their shields in a fish scale pattern. So it's been kind of like the idea is perhaps that the fish scale pattern, the formation was some people believe the testudo formation. And it's quite possible this may have been the case because, you know, Roman soldiers were professional. They were a professional army. So the training that they had would have stayed with them. They were seasoned soldiers. So it's actually quite possible this would have happened. So the fight for the town was intense. The Chinese prevailed. And subsequently, the Chinese under the Han Dynasty at this point, who were at the height of their power, began their kind of westward expansion. And it's quite possible that, I mean, I wasn't really kind of able to find out, but it's quite possible that if there were kind of any soldiers that had surrendered or were captured, then they may have ended up in the Han Chinese army. So, just going to go back to the part about the fish scale as well. So, when I kind of mentioned about the testudo formation and the professional practices of the Roman soldiers, it's quite interesting because I think that these Romans, these soldiers, would have been in their same kind of company for many, many years. So I think it's quite possible that if they were border guards, one of the things that the Romans actually did, and this is quite interesting as well, is they actually continued their training. So I think, this is my opinion, I think that if these soldiers had been captured by the Parthians, had been shipped over to Merv, had then ended up fighting in this battle against the Han Chinese, then they would have kind of kept up their training. Now, I can appreciate, however, that there's a good kind of 17, 20-year kind of gap. So a lot of these soldiers, assuming that they were in their 30s, may have been in their 50s, you know. So, I mean, age might have kind of slowed them down a bit. That might not be the case, but I like to kind of think it was. So, moving on. The Chinese were so impressed by these foreign warriors that they put them into another border town. Now, this time they were guarding the border. They were guarding the border between China and Tibet, as because the Tibetan people at the time were kind of like the border kind of reavers in Scotland. You know, they would kind of go into kind of like China, raid, and then come back out. So it's believed that there was anywhere between 100 to 1,000 or more soldiers which established themselves in this town. And it was known by the Chinese as, I believe, Li Quan or Li Jin, which is pronounced as Li Jin. So, you know, it's quite possible that these soldiers settled in this town and essentially, you know, maybe they were the legionnaires that fought for the Chinese. Another kind of interesting fact that I found out about this was that these men have been reported by Chinese historians. These men have been reported to have used tools such as a tree trunk counterweight construction device. Now, it's not specifically known exactly what that might have been, but it was used to reinforce the area into a square fort. Now, square forts were very common by the Romans. It was actually quite a common sight in the Mediterranean. I believe even the Greeks kind of used a similar kind of like idea as well. But it was actually quite rare in Asia. So again, that's another reason why I believe perhaps that, you know, these legionnaires may have fought for the Chinese and may have actually ended up there. Now, this is going to be another point that I'm going to discuss as well, and this really is actually perhaps they weren't actually legionnaires at all, but I found this quite interesting as well. Perhaps they were actually Greek hoplites. So the reason why I kind of say this is Alexander the Great, when he's kind of, you know, conquering shit, he's just gonna kind of, you know, fuck you Persia, fuck you India, you know, basically kind of fuck you to everybody, right? So he's kind of going across, and he decides that because he's, you know, quite a big-headed fuck as well, he's like, you know, this is Alexandria here and this is Alexandria here. So he starts setting up these kind of colonies, right? And this is really interesting.
Proper bloody narcissistic, isn't he?
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's Alexandria in Egypt. There was, like, what was it? Alexandria on the Oxus Seas or whatever the fuck it was called. And this one, the one I'm going to talk about now, is Alexandria ex Chatty. I think that's how you say it. Or Dayun by the Chinese. And this was part of a kingdom of called Fergana, which is in the modern area of Uzbekistan, southern Kyrgyzstan, and possibly northern Tajikistan as well. So it was known that Alexander would get his soldiers, you know, the ones that were old as fuck and had families. They would go, right, I tell you what, you can settle here and then get pensioned off, basically. So it's quite possible that one of Alexander's colonies existed at this particular moment in time. Again, I'm going to go back to another wee point as well. So they got the Kingdom of Fergana, which in all likelihood, I believe is actually quite, you know, quite accurate, because at the same token of time, or roughly around this time, we also had another kingdom called the Indo-Greco Kingdom, which lasted from roughly about 120 BC to 8 AD. And the Greek hoplites were quite known to be mercenaries. So they quite liked the whole idea of kind of like soldiering and adventuring. And again, this is something that actually Alexander himself was confronted with in the Battle of Granicus between Alexander the Great and the Achaemenid Empire, in which it was believed that anywhere between 5,000 to 20,000 Greek hoplite mercenaries fought for the Achaemenid Empire. So it's actually quite possible that the fish scale formation, or these soldiers that practiced this formation, were in fact actually hoplites. So I've not really kind of been able to find out if it was the actual Romans or if it was the kind of Greeks. Regardless, though, however, I still think it's quite fascinating that despite, you know, how far east the Han Empire was and how, you know, alien they would have been to kind of like perhaps the Greek settlers and the kind of Roman legionaries, they actually still fought for them. So that's my segment.
That's really cool. I think it's plausible that that would have happened.
I mean, one of the really kind of interesting things that I've been kind of reading up recently is about kind of like ancient civilizations and their colonies. Look at kind of like Carthage. Carthage was a Phoenician colony. Phoenicians were originally kind of from round about kind of Lebanon. And then even if you look at kind of Marseille today, I mean, Marseille, I believe, comes from the Greek word Massilia, which was again a Greek colony. And Alexander was renowned for kind of establishing these kind of colonies, certainly in the East, because he really kind of wanted to kind of build up his kind of like his empire, and he wanted to essentially, when these colonists would establish a colony, you know, they would have children, they would be brought up as Greeks, they would have Greek knowledge, Greek influence, Greek religion, and they would also have Greek military tactics as well, because at the time it was believed it was the best. So I think it is entirely plausible that they were probably more likely Greek mercenary hoplites, or certainly Greek hoplites fighting, than they were legionnaires. But regardless, I still think it's quite an interesting mystery that I always kind of thought was quite cool.
I agree. That's very interesting, thank you. Right, so does anyone have anything further that they want to talk about, or shall we move on to the quiz?
Quiz?
We could just do a quiz, yeah.
Grand. Okay, so fastest finger forward, please, and in no particular order. Who was the mother of the princes in the tower?
Elizabeth Woodville.
Point Woodville. Kelly. Which infamous slave and rebel did Marcus Licinius Crassus defeat?
Spartacus.
Point Cam.
And Marcus Licinius Crassus. Sorry, I had to get that in somewhere.
Yeah, I know, I've been doing the whole thing the whole time Cam was talking. Who first wrote about Atlantis in 360 BC?
Plato.
Point both. Beyond the Pillars of Hercules describes what geographical feature?
Atlantic Ocean.
Point Kelly. What was the name of the leader of the Roman army at the Battle of Carrhae in Turkey?
Fuck. Marcus Licinius Crassus. Yeah. Oh, I was fucking talking about him. Jesus,
point
fuck.
Cam. What was the name of the first child born?
Literally just said his name 2 seconds ago.
I know.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I know.
What was the name of the first child born to English parents in the New World?
Virginia Dare.
Correct. Point Kelly. Who was the other potential royal killer of the princes in the tower?
Penrhyn Tudor.
Correct. Point both. Walter Raleigh was given the rights to the lands of Virginia between which two pre-existing states? A point per state.
Newfoundland and Florida?
Correct. 2 points, Kelly. And finally, a battle with which major Greek city-state saw the punishment of the city of Atlantis by the Greek gods?
Athens.
Point Kelly. Kelly, I think you win that one. Thank you very much, everybody. That was really, really interesting. I hope everyone listening enjoyed it. And we will speak to you again next week. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Ta-ta.